From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dolb. Thank you so much for being here with us tonight. Coming up, the American Lung Association's hosting the Hudson Valley Lung Force Walk this Saturday. Patricio Rabayo has those details coming up in the second half of the program. And we've got some encouraging environmental news. A new report shows state laws are successfully driving PFAS forever chemicals out of clothing and other products. We check in with Kate Donovan from the NRDC about that report and her organization's take on the New York State legislative session that just wrapped up. And we start tonight with another environmental story. As the Trump administration visits upstate New York to encourage hydraulic fracturing and a pipeline through the western Catskills to carry natural gas, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin was in Binghamton on Monday to make the case for the same natural gas pipeline that failed to get permits when it was first proposed. As New York Public News Network's Celia Clark reports, environmentalists want the state to reject the project for good.
EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin came to Binghamton on Monday to urge support for the Constitution Pipeline Project. If built, the pipeline would go through the Catskills and Southern Tier to connect with other pipelines near Albany. Zeldin says the gas would go to New England states.
Millions of New Englanders are desperate for New York to allow a pipeline to be built through it to deliver Pennsylvania natural gas to millions of New Englanders.
He says he was there when President Trump and Governor Kathy Hochul talked about the project last year. The State Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC, determined the proposed Constitution Pipeline application was incomplete three times. The developer withdrew the application last year.
I've heard the governor express a desire to get Constitution Pipeline over the finish line. And that was her position until it wasn't.
Ken Lovett is an energy and environment advisor to Governor Hochul. In a statement to WSKG, he says, quote, Governor Hochul, as part of her all-of-the-above energy strategy to keep the lights on and costs down, has expressed an openness to natural gas as long as the proposals comply with all state laws and regulations. Under Governor Hochul, New York will continue to be a clean energy and climate leader, even in the face of unending roadblocks put up by Washington Republicans, end quote. Zeldin says the pipeline will help with American energy independence. It would also bring fracking to New York State. Fracking has been banned in New York since 2014.
I believe stronger now than I ever have in the past that New York should be reversing its ban on the extraction of natural gas.
He says the Constitution Pipeline would bring more municipal taxes and business revenue across the region. Zeldin says fracking technology is safer now and poses no harm to the environment.
We're not going back.
A couple of hours after Zeldin spoke, over 40 protesters gathered a block away to speak out against fracking and the Constitution Pipeline. One of them is biologist Sandra Steingraber, who was a leader in the anti-fracking movement.
14 years ago, New York State banned fracking on the grounds that fracking imperiled water and human health and that no technology, no rules, no regulations could mitigate the dangers of this form of gas extraction.
The DEC based its approval of the fracking ban on scientific research conducted over several years.
And we now have five times as much evidence as we did 12 years ago. And those data all say the same thing, which is fracking imperils water, air, and health.
Those who gathered believe Zeldin's visit to Binghamton is part of an effort by President Trump and the gas industry to override the will of New Yorkers who in large numbers supported a ban on fracking. In Binghamton, Celia Clark for the New York Public News Network.
And thank you to Celia and the New York Public News Network for that report. Well, for our next environmental story, we've finally got some encouraging news after years of alarming headlines about PFAS contamination in drinking water, soil, and consumer products. A new report from the Natural Resources Defense Council finds that state laws in New York and California are dramatically reducing levels of PFAS, often called forever chemicals, and reducing them in products like raincoats, athletic wear, and other textiles. And we're getting this news after New York lawmakers wrapped up their legislative session advancing some PFAS-related measures while leaving others unresolved. For her take on all of this, Tim Bruno spoke with Kate Donovan of the NRDC live this morning on Radio Chatskill.
Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Nice to be back.
Let's talk about that report, which sounds a little encouraging. It found dramatic reductions in PFAS levels in textiles after restrictions took effect in New York and California. What stands out most to you from those findings?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a really important, project for us to do. As you mentioned, New York and California banned PFAS in textiles and apparel, and those laws came into effect of January of last year. And just to note, though, California's law bans PFAS in a broad range of textiles, including, tablecloths and furniture, where New York is slightly different, where we've only banned so far PFAS in apparel, which would be raincoats, athletic wear, anything that we wear on our body. So the laws are slightly different, but they came into effect at the same time. And what we wanted to do is figure out our companies and brands complying with these laws. So about 6 months after implementation, we tested, over 100 different products in both of these states, ranging from, like you said, coats and athletic pants to swimwear to outdoor textiles to tablecloths and pet products. And what we found was encouraging for the most part, specifically in the apparel and footwear and outdoor gear categories. We found that most of these brands had dramatically reduced the levels of PFAS in their products, because there had been some testing earlier that, especially with raincoats and outerwear, of showing high levels of PFAS. So the market has definitely adjusted to those new laws, and it's encouraging that brands are seeking to be in compliant with those.
Something that jumped out to me was the report finding reductions of up to 99.99% in some outdoor apparel products, not all. But what does that tell us about the ability of manufacturers to adapt when regulations are enacted?
Yeah, I mean, it tells us a couple of things. One, it tells us that the technologies and the safer alternatives exist. And we kind of knew that, right? Because when these laws came into effect, brands were already starting to transition out of it. It just helped these laws that were passed help the laggards kind of catch up and force them to move these safer alternatives. So we know that it's possible. We know that it doesn't have much impact on the consumers. We didn't report any kind of disruption in consumers being able to find the materials or the products that they wanted to find. And there is no indication that the prices of these products increased by any measure. And we also know that these type of laws, brands for the most part want to comply or do comply.
And so that report does challenge some of these claims that industry groups have often argued that replacing PFAS in products is difficult or impractical. Were there any other findings in the report that surprised you, either positively or negatively?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely some gaps, which was disappointing and also not surprising. So as I mentioned, there were categories of textiles that really were kind of not in compliance, both in California and in New York. And those included things like cloth diapers, tablecloths, and pet products. We tested several types of pet beds, pet covers, the kind of furniture cover that you would throw over your couch, as well as cloth diapers, which was also unfortunate.
I want to ask you about the New York legislature that adjourned on Friday. Everyone's looking back and analyzing what went right, what went wrong. So far, reviews not so good. From the PFAS-free New York campaign's perspective and the NRDC's perspective, what do you think about this last legislative session? And what were the biggest wins or disappointments?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was a mixed bag. So PFAS Free New York is a kind of group of campaign, a coalition of impacted community members, organizations, doctors, really a broad range that we've kind of pulled together over many years to work on a slate of PFAS pieces of legislation, because I think I've said on this program before, solving the PFAS contamination crisis is not one policy solution. It's an agenda, a suite of solutions that deal with upstream use and as well as the downstream impacts. So We were fortunate to get a couple bills passed that deal what we call downstream impacts. So one bill that passed the legislature is called the PFAS Discharge and Disclosure Act. Now, that requires entities or industries operating in New York with a water discharge permit, something called as a speedies permit, to actually test and disclose the types of PFAS that are coming out of their discharges. Now, this is an important bill to give us more information about where exactly these chemicals are being, you know, put into the environment. A lot of, you know, landfills are covered by this. So this will give us a lot more information of where to target and where to permit. Doesn't really do a whole lot about the amount of PFAS coming into the system. Those would be the upstream types of solutions. And another downstream bill that we have been working on is codifying the federal MCLs. Now, this is a little bit technical, but as we all might be aware, the federal government recently published rollbacks to these federal maximum contaminant levels for PFAS chemicals, in particular POFA, POFFs, and a couple others. Now, because that rollback has extended the time frame for those two really toxic PFAS, POFA and POFS, and scrapped the MCLs for another set of four chemicals, there was a bill this session that would basically say we'd codify what the federal government just rolled back to say New Yorkers still deserve those protections. We're not going to go backwards. And so that is important because that relates to how water utilities will then test and treat, which is the important part, for more than just POFA and POFS.
And was that specific to drinking water?
Yes. So that's a drinking water. The maximum contaminant level is a kind of drinking water regulatory program that basically says if a water utility is providing you water, it has to be under this level of contamination. And the level is quite low. So the federal government and New York in this new legislation set those limits at 4 parts per trillion for POFA and POFS, where previously they were at 10 parts per trillion.
You know, it's amazing to me that what we're talking about here are everyday things for folks, right? Drinking water, textiles, things you wear, things you cook with, cosmetics, with that bill didn't pass either. Many consumers assume these products are safe. How difficult is for consumers today to know whether products contain PFAS?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. There are no transparency laws, so these are not chemicals that need to be listed on ingredients. The best advice I always give to consumers, and we talk about it in our textile report, is look for the key, kind of the suspicious key terms, water resistant, stain resistant, nonstick, glide, any of these words that kind of suggest that something isn't going to adhere to it. Because we know that, that's what PFAS is, magic, I suppose, of why, it kind of has all of these properties, which is what has been kind of just ubiquitously promoted and used in all sorts of consumer products when we know there are safer alternatives available. It's cheaper and became more accessible.
Looking ahead, what do you expect to bring those proposals back or the PFAS-free New York campaign to bring back proposals addressing cookware, cosmetic, and other consumer products in 2027?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to be clear, the state Senate passed these bills. They have been big supporters. The assembly has been a problem on a lot of environmental legislation, but in particular, these two PFAS bills dealing with PFAS upstream. I mean, I find it shocking that all of the downstream efforts that we're doing to test, to filter out, to find out are important, but do no good if you're not ultimately turning off the tap to the use and production of these chemicals upstream. We kind of continually will have this cycle of filtering and testing, but ultimately not solving the problem. So the upstream bills are really important to start getting to the root cause of this contamination crisis.
And the report we were talking about suggesting that state-level action has been effective when it comes to some of the textile things we were talking about. And we also talked about the rollback of stronger federal regulations. In the absence of those stronger federal regulations or those rollbacks, how important are state laws in addressing PFAS contamination?
It's so important. I mean, we feel, in New York, I feel fortunate that we have you know, we've had actually MCLs before the federal government, right? Many states across the United States have been implementing these, at least these water requirements, but now there will be lots of states that don't have those protections. And the fact that New York is going, is making their standards stronger is super important. And we need to lead on getting these chemicals out of consumer products. You know, there was a time where New York really was taking the lead at, you know, pulling these chemicals out of consumer products. And we've kind of been a little bit stagnant for many years in addressing the next set of category of products. And just to be clear, when we regulate these chemicals in these particular product categories, it's not that there aren't already safer alternatives already available on the market, right? It's not that the brands and the industries can't adjust. It's just they haven't. And something that's really important, we're not trying to regulate a use where there's no solution and there's no alternative at this point in time. It's what we would call they're completely unnecessary.
Do you think lawmakers will take a lesson from this report and see that there is effectiveness when folks are willing to comply?
I really hope so. I mean, I hope this report really does show that, one, there are gaps where New York hasn't regulated yet in terms of the other textiles, because that other bill I was mentioning covered the remaining textiles that we know are non-compliant, like pet products and tablecloths and diapers. And it also hopefully gives them, you know, more confidence that when they pass a law that, you know, phases out something or bans the use of the chemicals, companies comply. And there's really not much disruption to the marketplace.
And do you think it gives the public some hope, considering the lack of transparency and some of the alarming headlines we've seen over the years about PFAS?
Absolutely. And I think reports like this where we test are super important, because it gives us some more confidence that we can, you know, that share that, you know, these laws are actually working and they are worth our effort and they are important public health measures.
That's Kate Donovan of the NRDC talking about the report showing forever chemicals, PFAS, dropping after state laws phase out PFAS in some textiles. There's more information at nrdc.org. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thanks, Tim.
It is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And the American Lung Association is inviting the Hudson Valley community to the 2026 Lung Force Walk. It's happening Saturday at Manhattanville University in Purchase, New York. The annual event raises money for lung cancer research, education, advocacy, and support services for people living with lung disease. This year's medical honoree is Dr. Brendan Stiles, professor and chief of thoracic surgery and surgical oncology at Montefiore Einstein. For more Radio Catskills, Patricio Rabayo spoke with Dr. Stiles and Lisa Birdsey, development director with the American Lung Association.
Lisa, I wanted to start with you first. You know, for people who may not be familiar, what is the Lung Force Walk in the Hudson Valley?
Yeah, so we have our Lung Force Walk Hudson Valley each year at Manhattanville University in Purchase. This is our 11th annual walk, and we're expecting more than 600 participants to come out and to walk in support of lung cancer research, early detection, and programs for people impacted by lung disease. The walk raises critical funds for the American Lung Association to end lung cancer and lung disease through research, early education, advocacy, and patient support. And to get a kind of an idea of what the day looks like, our scheduled events is roughly 9:30 to 10:30. We have registration, live music, and a bunch of activations on the field and exhibitors to visit. 10:30, we have an opening ceremony. 11 o'clock, we actually kick off the walk itself. And then 12 o'clock, we have a closing ceremony, announce some fun raffle winners, and have a little barbecue on the field. And it's family friendly, appropriate for all ages, and a great opportunity to really educate the community and spread awareness.
Right, right. And this is the 11th annual walk. So how has the event has grown over the years, Lisa?
It's grown a lot, as well as just, I think, awareness in the community around lung health, which is, you know, the primary purpose of the walk. So it's just really exciting kind of to see the expansion. But as we mentioned, we're in the 11th annual walk, and last year was the 10th annual, which was our big anniversary year. And it was exciting because we actually crossed the $1 million mark for fundraising over the 10 years, which was a really amazing milestone to reach. And we've engaged now almost 1 million members of the local community to come out and support us, as well as local businesses and the hospital systems throughout the area. We've just seen tremendous growth and interest, and that's kind of where we need to continue heading.
Yeah, absolutely. And this year, Dr. Stiles, you are being honored this year as the 2026 medical honoree. What does that mean to you? What does that kind of recognition mean to you?
Well, I love it, and I'm incredibly appreciative for that honor. I really think it really speaks to my patients, though, and we're doing this for the patients and for their caregivers. Lung cancer, you know, as you may or may not know, is the leading cause of cancer death in the United States, and so everybody knows somebody who's been touched with lung cancer. And we sort of stigmatize and associate it with smoking, and yes, that's the most common cause, but about 1 in 5 out of my patients is a never smoker, so it really can affect everybody, and we're out there walking for lung health. I've often been a huge advocate for research, for clinical trials, for advances in lung cancer. But most importantly, I'm an advocate for my patients and for all these people that are going to be out there together walking.
Yeah. And you spoke in the past, as far as I know, that you lost your father to advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. My father was a dairy farmer in Virginia, a great guy. And in his early 60s, he was diagnosed with lung cancer. That was before we had lung cancer screening. That was before we had targeted therapy, before we had immunotherapy. And just to think about the progress that we've made since my dad passed away is another great reason to go out and walk. This critical funding that we talk about to maintain research, to help patients get the information that they need so that we can sort of change the face of lung cancer.
Now how has that experience with your father sort of shaped your career as a physician and a surgeon?
Yeah, a ton. I mean, you know, we're doing better with advanced stage lung cancer, but if we can find lung cancer early, then I, as a surgeon, can really cure people. And so that's always my goal. And so here at Montefiore Einstein, we've worked hard to expand incidental nodule programs, but more importantly, lung cancer screening throughout the Bronx, but also throughout Hudson Valley. And so everybody who's coming to walk and everybody's thinking about this should see if he or she is eligible for lung cancer screening. If you have lung nodules, you should ask to get them checked out, because those are the biggest steps to finding cancer early.
You mentioned about early detection, and, you know, you wish that that sort of technology was there around when your father got sick. Can you just go, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of advances. Can you talk about some of the advances of lung cancer detection since in the many recent years?
Yes, I would be happy to. My dad actually was enrolled in an early lung cancer screening program before it was actually approved for reimbursement. And so we're even thinking about it then. Since then, based on large trials, it's now approved by insurances and by Medicare and Medicaid. And it's for patients who have a smoking history and for patients who are of a certain age. That, I think, alone, just getting in those programs is a great way. And it's a CT scan. It's easy to do. It gives you a big picture of lung health as well, of heart health, of all these other things that you get, the advantages that you get. It's quite easy to do. But I also think we have to think about the 20% of patients who weren't smokers, or the maybe 30, 40% of patients diagnosed with lung cancer who were never eligible or who are no longer eligible for screening. And that's where you need community efforts like this, raising awareness. That's where you need programs to identify those patients early. If they have a scan for something else and you happen to see a lung nodule, really just making sure that they're getting the appropriate follow-up. And we are super excited about doing this better throughout the Hudson Valley.
This walk is happening in Manhattanville in Purchase. Lisa, the money, the fundraising goal is $200,000. Is that correct?
And that is correct.
And where does that money actually go? If you want to just give an overview of that.
Yeah, so we're really proud. The Lung Association, all the money we raise, 98 cents of every dollar goes towards our mission. So that goes to research efforts, that goes towards programming, that goes towards advocacy efforts too, where we actually have staff and heroes that we work with that actually go and lobby to put lung health, you know, on the government's radar too, and making sure that is part of public policy efforts that happen nationwide and locally. So that's kind of where we would see a big difference too, and obviously a big difference in awareness too.
Yeah. Dr. Stiles, you mentioned, you know, the common knowledge, or people always think that people who get lung cancer are smokers. And you mentioned that it is possible not to be a smoker, still get lung cancer. So when people hear lung cancer, what do you wish they better understood about the disease today?
Yeah, there's an incredible stigma associated with it, and you'll often hear patients diagnosed with lung cancer. The first question they get asked is, well, how much did you smoke? And that we don't do that kind of blame game for any other cancer. And so I wish people knew that there's multiple other reasons for lung cancer, whether it's environmental, whether it's some genetic risk factors or other sources. And I do think people should know that literally one out of five patients that I see with lung cancer were never smokers, not even just smoked a little bit, but never smokers. So I need more research to find ways to identify those patients, to sort of enroll those patients to screening programs and for prevention. And I really think, you know, the common saying is that anybody with lungs can get lung cancer. I want people to know that.
You talked about, I think it was in the press release, you talked about biomarker-driven treatment. Can you explain exactly what that means?
Yeah, never before have we had more tools to treat lung cancer. Lung cancer is not just lung cancer like it was in the old days. There's all different subtypes of lung cancer, and some are driven by very specific mutations in the cancer that we can target with very specific drugs. Some are driven by multiple things, but we can target those with immunotherapy and sort of broad approaches to get the body's immune system to attack the cancer. And so we've never had better tools to treat lung cancer. We just need to find it. But importantly, we need to know what kind of lung cancer it is, not just a big, broad topic, a very specific molecular signature of that cancer so that we can treat it accurately.
Now, Lisa, for those who are interested in partaking in the walk, how can people register, donate, volunteer, or form a team?
Yeah, no, those opportunities are all still available. The website is the best place to get started, lungforest.org/Hudson Valley. Registration's free, open online until next Friday, June 12th at 1. There'll also be on-site registration available on event day. So if you don't get a chance, totally okay to come. Sign up that day too. Always welcome. But yeah, there's opportunities to participate as a walker, to form a team, to volunteer, and even still any last minute sponsorship interest too, we could still make that happen as well.
Before we leave, I just want to ask both of you, you know, Dr. Stiles, we can start with you. What is the main message you want people in the Hudson Valley to take away from this year's lung course?
Mostly I just want to know that lung cancer can affect everybody, but the diagnosis of lung cancer doesn't mean the doom and gloom that it used to be associated with. I'll be walking with a lady who had advanced lung cancer, got all this modern therapy we talked about, and then had her whole lung taken out, and I bet she'll beat me in the walk. She just operated on her earlier this year, and with one lung, she's going to challenge anybody that day. So come out and see sort of the energy and the spirit and survivors of lung cancer, but also hear the stories about the incredible progress we've made.
Yeah. And how about you, Lisa?
Yeah, I would echo that. And, you know, like we mentioned, too, while the statistics around lung cancer are very serious, just spreading the message that there is a lot of hope and there are all of these advancements and in detection and treatment, and more people are surviving lung cancer than ever before. So just, you know, the goal is to continue to grow awareness, get lung health on people's radar, start having conversations with your physician, and, you know, just get everyone informed. I think that's the most important thing.
We're talking to Dr. Miranda Stiles, the 2026 Lung Force Walk Hudson Valley Medical Honoree, Lisa Bertzi, Development Director with the American Lung Association. The Hudson Valley Lung Force Walk takes place on Saturday, June 13th at the Manhattanville University in Purchase. Registration is open at lungforce.org/Hudson Valley. So thank you so much, both of you, for joining me on this program.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Patricio, for that conversation. Thank you, listener, for being here with me. That is it for me. I'm Jason Dole. This has been the Local Edition, but I will be back tomorrow for more Local Edition. Coming up at 7, we got 2 hours of the Retro Cocktail Hour, followed by 1 hour of Virtual Soundscapes with Matt Hurtado. Before that, we do have more news coming up next from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The DeBruce in Livingston Manor, New York, a restaurant and hotel overlooking the Willowemoc Valley, featuring 12 guest rooms, 2 restaurant experiences, and an endless backyard for fly fishing and hiking. TheDeBruce.com. From Grizzly Bagels, small batch, handmade, New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York. GrizzlyBagels.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Take a dive into the deep end, the ultimate rock music journey. Deep cuts, live tracks, and rare gems from rock, psychedelia, country, jazz, and blues. Experience the deep cuts on the deep end. Friday nights at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. local news, culture, and NPR.